Hey, welcome to Deal Memo, your personalized feed for industry news you care about. The architecture of this industry is repricing all at once in the same window. The legal architecture of a $111 billion merger, challenged yesterday by five people with cable subscriptions and a 46-page federal filing. The physical architecture of New York's most storied sound stages, now in foreclosure, $340 million past due. And 12 days before Cannes opens, Korea and Japan have built a joint venture designed to reach global audiences without rooting through Hollywood first. Today, the consumer lawsuit that just became the wild card in the Paramount-Warner merger saga, Deutsche Bank going after Kaufman Astoria, and the Korea-Japan content play that's bigger than the press release makes it look...
Three stories, one red. Who's holding the asset when the correction arrives? The merger opponents are down to private citizens because the institutions haven't moved. Hackman Capital is holding studios it can't service the debt on. And CJENM, TBS, and Unext are building infrastructure at exactly the moment everyone else is liquidating it. The correction separates the buyers from the people who bought at the peak.
Every chapter of the Paramount-Warner merger has introduced a new kind of opponent, state attorneys general from California and New York, an A-list letter-writing campaign, Ellison's dinner with Trump at the renamed Institute of Peace, an FCC foreign ownership filing, the April 23rd stockholder vote, now five private citizens, Pamela Faust, Len Marazzo, Lisa McCarthy, Deborah Rubenzone, and Gary Tolowski filed a 46-page antitrust complaint Thursday in California federal court. Three of them are Paramount Plus subscribers. Two are prospective subscribers. The suit is titled Save CNN. The central legal theory is viewpoint diversity as a consumer harm, and the plaintiffs are also seeking to unravel last year's Paramount Skydance deal, not just the Warner acquisition. Paramount called it without merit within hours.
The standing question is what I'd want answered first in that courtroom. Private consumer antitrust standing to block a media merger is unusual territory. The DOJ has it. State AGs have it. But a streaming subscriber arguing her news choices get worse when two studios merge. The bar requires imminent, concrete, personal injury. I might have fewer content options as a thin claim in front of a federal judge.
The complaint anticipates exactly that. It argues the April 23rd WBD shareholder vote is what activated their standing claim. Their language is that the threatened injury to plaintiffs became substantially more imminent because the remaining barriers to consummation were principally regulatory and closing condition barriers rather than stockholder approval. They're timing the standing argument to a specific documentable event in the deal's progress. That's deliberate drafting.
It's clever, I'll give them that. There's a real law firm behind this with a specific theory, and the filing runs 46 pages of graph-filled economic analysis. This is not a protest document. Whether a federal judge accepts the viewpoint diversity argument on its own merits is genuinely uncertain, but the timing piece is sophisticated.
The Save CNN framing is what gives this cultural weight, and it matters independent of the legal theory. There's genuine fear in the media world that CNN ends up marginalized or reshaped inside whatever the combined Paramount-Warner entity looks like. The complaint says it plainly. Placing CNN under Paramount's control would reduce the number of independent owners capable of sustaining national television news operations at scale. That's a journalism infrastructure argument layered on top of the antitrust claim.
And the market concentration math in the complaint is substantive. Combined Paramount-Warner at 23.6% of the studio market. That makes them the largest studio in the industry, ahead of Disney at 21.4% and Universal at 20%. Top four studios controlling 76% of the market, eliminating Paramount as an independent competitor at that concentration level. Those numbers run on established antitrust framework. The viewpoint diversity piece is newer ground, but the concentration argument has teeth.
And Paramount came back fast. Their exact statement, "We are aware of the private action filed today in federal district court and are confident that it is without merit. The combination of Paramount and WBD will create a stronger competitor that is well-positioned to serve as a champion for creative talent and consumer choice." Short and dismissive, which is the right posture for a company that wants to signal this, changes nothing.
Right posture. And the suit probably changes nothing immediately in terms of the closing timeline. But here's the strategic read. Even a filing that gets dismissed in 60 days buys time. Every week this case is alive in federal court is a week the deal hasn't closed. The real leverage for the deal's opponents has never been winning in court. It's using every available channel to slow the clock and raise the carrying cost.
Marcus, do you think a federal judge actually takes the viewpoint diversity argument seriously on its merits? Or is this case doing its real work in the press regardless of the ruling?
The press is the play. Every story this case generates is a reminder to every regulator, senator, and WBD advertiser that this deal is contested. Liability in a courtroom, asset in the news cycle. The filing fee is cheap for what it buys in coverage.
And there's one structural thing I keep coming back to. The complaint threads two distinct arguments: consumer price harm and editorial independence. Those are genuinely different claims. One is antitrust. The other is almost a First Amendment argument about news diversity. Whether weaving them together in one filing is smart or a vulnerability depends on who's reading it.
5 citizens, 46 pages, federal court in California. The deal's opponents have moved through every institutional actor available and arrived at private citizens with streaming subscriptions. But the clock is what matters, and the clock is still running on David Ellison's carrying costs. This story is physical. Brick, steel, 11 sound stages in Queens. Kaufman Astoria Studios opened in 1920 as the original home of Paramount Pictures. Saturday Night Live filmed there. Orange is the New Black, The Irishman, Men in Black 3. And this week, Deutsche Bank filed a foreclosure complaint in New York State Supreme Court, a $340 million loan from 2021, due in full last November 9th, never paid. The outstanding balance as of March 26th, including interest, late charges, and exit fees, is $359 million. Hackman Capital Partners, which acquired the studio in 2022, has declined to comment.
This is the production real estate correction arriving in its clearest form. Hackman was the most aggressive buyer in the 2020 to 2022 window. Kaufman Astoria, Silver Cup Studios in New York, the Radford Studio Center in L.A. Every acquisition was underwritten against utilization assumptions that made sense when every streamer was in a green light arms race. The arms race ended. The debt didn't.
And Radford is the scariest data point in the portfolio. Hackman defaulted on Radford earlier this year. Goldman Sachs took it over, and Netflix is now in talks to buy it. Two major U.S. properties in default within months of each other. That's a portfolio level problem, not a property level one.
Right. And Radford going to Goldman and potentially to Netflix is actually a workable outcome for that asset. Well-capitalized buyer, existing production relationships, clear operational fit. But Kaufman Astoria is a different buyer universe. 11 stages, 100 years of institutional history, a New York identity. Finding an equivalent buyer there is a harder problem. Elena, who does that even get sold to?
That's the question nobody has answered yet. A real estate investor is one possibility. A streamer with East Coast production ambitions is another. But the historic significance cuts both ways. It raises the profile and raises the complication of any deal.
I want to put the people question on the table because the headline is Hackman Capital and Deutsche Bank. But an 11-stage complex in Queens is real for crew members, local vendors, the IATSE members who depend on an active East Coast production ecosystem. Kaufman has been a backbone of New York production for decades. What does a messy, protracted foreclosure mean for the workers who show up there?
That's the question the legal filing doesn't answer. A clean acquisition by a well-capitalized buyer. You preserve the stages, the production capacity, the jobs continue. A foreclosure that stalls in litigation for 2 or 3 years is genuinely damaging to the New York production community in ways that don't show up in any of the court documents.
There's a two-tier story crystallizing across the whole production real estate market. Hudson Pacific just exited all its leased L.A. soundstage facilities except Griffith Park. Same correction showing up. But their owned Sunset Studios is running at 96% occupancy, and their new Manhattan facility is 100% leased. Purpose-built, best-in-class, prime locations, those are fine. Everything else is carrying debt it can't service.
Vintage square footage with boom-era financing. That's the risk profile defaulting right now.
The debt was underwritten against streaming greenlight volumes running 2 or 3 times current levels. Lenders looked at those utilization rates, wrote the loans, the utilization collapsed. Deutsche Bank is done extending patience. Goldman already moved on Radford. The repricing is happening on the lender's timeline now, not the industry's.
One more piece worth flagging. Hackman still holds a significant international portfolio. Eastbrook Studios in London, Cardington in Bedford, Ardmore Studios in Ireland. Those properties sit in markets with strong government incentive structures that have kept production volumes more stable. So this correction is hitting American studio real estate specifically harder because the international markets have structural production subsidies that the U.S. doesn't have.
And that's the uncomfortable loop. Productions leave New York and L.A. for cheaper incentive markets. Utilization drops at Kauffman and Radford. The debt can't be serviced. Deutsche Bank forecloses. The incentive structure that pushed production overseas is now showing up in the foreclosure filings on the American facilities left behind. The industry built the subsidy structure that's now foreclosing on its own infrastructure.
Context first, because the Korea-Japan piece of this is more significant than the headline captures. These are two content markets with historically complicated political and commercial relationships. Geopolitical friction kept most K-content out of Japan's mainstream market for a long time. That barrier has been falling fast on streaming, but the institutional move is what happened this week. CJENM, Japan's TBS, Tokyo Broadcasting System, not the American cable network, and Unext Holdings have launched a joint venture called Studio Manowa. Mano means story in Japanese. Wa means harmony. They signed the deal in Seoul, and the structure covers everything from original IP discovery through production, global distribution, and spin-off businesses.
Walk me through who's bringing what, because the three-way split is where I'm most skeptical.
CJENM is the production engine. The Korean conglomerate that financed Parasite runs Studio Dragon, built K-drama into a genuine global export machine. Tokyo Broadcasting System brings IP discovery and a global production arm called The Seven, which made Alice in Borderland. And TBS recently made a strategic investment in Legendary Entertainment, which signals ambition well beyond Japanese broadcast. Unext is Japan's leading premium streamer, passed 5 million subscribers last year, 9 consecutive years of revenue growth. They serve as the primary distribution platform for whatever Studio Manowa produces.
Clean division of labor on paper. But there have been dozens of Korea-Japan co-production deals over the last decade that never became much. What's structurally different about this one? My daughter has strong opinions about every TBS title in the anime catalog. I'd like to tell her this one actually sticks.
Two things make it different. First, it's a shared equity structure building original IP from scratch. A lifetime value model that covers secondary works, spin-offs, and global distribution rights. That's closer to building a studio than signing a co-production deal. Second, the Legendary investment tells you TBS's ambition has outgrown Japanese broadcast. They're building for global scale IP. That's genuine signal.
SOS, this is the global corridor argument that actually matters here. Japan's content market is worth roughly $45 billion. Original IP accounts for around $17 billion of that. Japanese streaming is growing at about 20% annually. If Studio Manowa builds a production and distribution axis between Seoul and Tokyo that operates at scale, that's a pathway for Asian IP to reach global audiences without a Netflix licensing deal or a Hollywood co-production structure sitting in the middle of it.
Does it actually bypass that or does it postpone it? At some scale, you still need truly global reach, which puts you back in conversation with Netflix, Amazon, Apple. The JV builds the IP. Someone still distributes it outside Asia.
What changes is the negotiating position. Right now, when CJENM has a hit K-drama, a global platform buys the rights and takes most of the upside. If CJENM arrives at that negotiation with Unext already distributing in Japan and TBS driving awareness across Asia, they're a content infrastructure, not just a content supplier. The terms of that conversation are different.
Yeah, I'll buy that. Leverage compounds over time if they execute.
And the can's timing is deliberate. CJENM CEO Yoon Sang-hyun said the goal is to introduce hit content targeting not only Asia, but the global market. TBS president and CEO Abe Ryujiro framed it as a trinity, CJENM's production DNA, TBS's creative expertise, Unext's platform reach. This drops 12 days before the Croisette opens. Studio Manawa is going to be in that market looking for European co-production partners and distribution deals. The announcement is the press conference. Cannes is where the deal-making actually begins.
And for Korean and Japanese creators, writers, directors, showrunners, this is a genuinely interesting development. The path to global audiences through Hollywood has meant the platform sets the parameters. The platform owns the global rights. CJENM's CEO put it directly. They want to integrate K-content systematic planning capabilities with global production expertise from the initial IP development stage. Building for global reach through companies from your own industry. The intent is there. Whether it holds in practice depends entirely on what they make.
Cautiously interested? The three-way equity structure is smarter than most of these deals. The legendary investment is more serious than anything I've seen out of a Japanese broadcaster. And they timed the Cannes announcement correctly. I'm still watching for execution. A joint venture is a press release until it produces something that travels globally. The first title out of this JV is the actual test. Roku broke out advertising revenue as its own reporting category for the first time this quarter. And the number landed well. $612.7 million in ad revenue, up 27% year over year. Total platform revenue hit $1.25 billion, up 22%. But the breakout itself is the signal. Roku is telling investors this is the line to watch. They're in advertising business now.
As Roku leans harder into advertising, how does that land with Netflix and Disney Plus, which both now have their own ad tiers and want those same premium video dollars?
There's a real conflict of interest building. Roku operates the platform those services live on. When Roku's primary revenue comes from selling ads alongside them, the incentives start to misalign. Netflix and Disney want to own their ad relationships directly. Roku wants the inventory. At some point, somebody renegotiates the deal terms, and that won't be a quiet conversation.
Apple services revenue crossed $30 billion for the first time. Best March quarter ever. Apple TV Plus lives inside services, which means we're still no closer to knowing if it's a real standalone business or a customer retention feature for iPhone buyers. Apple still doesn't break out streaming separately, and that opacity is a deliberate choice. This is also the first earnings call since Tim Cook announced he's stepping down September 1st. Incoming CEO John Ternus made a cameo on the call.
Ternus is a hardware and engineering executive. Cook was a supply chain operator who decided media drives services revenue. The strategic question hanging over Apple TV Plus is whether the new CEO inherits the streaming thesis or starts asking what the unit looks like on its own merit. He hasn't signaled either way. The second half of this year is when that starts to become clear.
First Star Wars movie in 7 years is tracking 80 million or more for the Memorial Day four-day weekend, The Mandalorian and Grogu. Here's what I want to put on the table. The Baby Yoda moment in 2019 was surprise. It was a character nobody knew existed, walking into a room and breaking the internet. Grogu is now one of the most recognized characters in popular culture. Nostalgia and affection are a different commercial engine than novelty. The question Disney is answering this Memorial Day is whether one can carry what the other did.
80 million. What's the business signal if that holds?
80 is proof of concept that theatrical Star Wars works in this market. At this level of franchise caution, the sequel trilogy's weakest domestic opener still cleared well above that. But that was a different era, a different campaign. An 80 million floor in 2026 tells Disney the math works and the ceiling is still open. It's early tracking. The campaign has room to run.
Netflix overhauled its mobile app to add a vertical video feed called Clips, TikTok style, scrollable, designed to match how people actually use their phones. The stated goal is subscriber engagement. The unstated question is whether engagement is the destination or the entry point to something larger.
Right now, Clips is short-form previews of long-form content. This is a discovery mechanic, not a programming strategy. Netflix is acknowledging that mobile users scroll vertically, and the traditional browse grid doesn't capture that behavior. That's the right acknowledgement. At some point, someone in Los Gatos asks whether there's a standalone short-form content business sitting on top of that surface. We're not there yet, but the surface is being built.
Gen Z genuinely discovers content through vertical scroll. Netflix betting it can root that behavior toward long-form subscriptions is the right instinct. Sitting out the vertical format any longer was becoming a real engagement cost. Cannes opens in 12 days and packages are already moving. Mr. Smith Entertainment brings I Am Not Your Mother to the market. Psychological thriller, described as darkly funny, directed by Craig Johnson, written by Johnson and Ryan O'Connell. The cast, Carrie Coon coming off The White Lotus, Ben Platt, and Lucas Gage from Smile 2.
What does that cast combination signal to you about where this lands in the market?
It's engineered for European buyer interest. White Lotus travels globally, Smile 2 was a broad commercial hit, and Craig Johnson's track record gives the film its indie credibility. This is a mid-prestige independent with real talent relationships doing the packaging work. Probably not a competition title, but exactly what moves during market week on the Croisette. Mr. Smith is going to find buyers. That's my read. Back to you two.
Two things to watch. On the Paramount-Warner merger, the DOJ has been quiet since February and the legal clock is running. Watch whether California AG Rob Bonta, who telegraphed coordination weeks ago, or any other state AG files behind the consumer lawsuit's legal theory. That would change the calculus. And watch Cannes. Studio Manawa arrives at the Croisette in 12 days with a JV and no announced titles. What they pitch in those 5 market days tells you whether this is a real content infrastructure build or a very well-staged press event.
3 stories. Correction arrives differently for everyone in the room. Hackman bought studios at the peak and Deutsche Bank is foreclosing. The merger's opponents are down to 5 private citizens with cable subscriptions because the institutions haven't moved. And CJENM, TBS, and Unext signed a joint venture at the exact moment the correction is clearing space for new players. The people who bought at the peak are holding debt they can't service. The people building now get to write the terms. That tends to be how the next chapter starts.
All right, that's our show. As always, the stories we covered today don't end here. We'll be back soon with the next chapter. Thanks for listening.